Today, the most difficult part of the Brexit jigsaw, keeping a soft Irish border. And, in opinion, Professor Wendy Laura Belcher on why African literature is so underappreciated.
The proposal of the British government, as things stand, is not something we can accept. It replaces...
The government put forward those proposals. They must have known they were not going to work. They're collapsing the talks and engaging in a reckless blame game.
A no-deal Brexit will never be Ireland's choice. If it happens, it'll be a decision made by the British government.
A German chancellor telling a British prime minister that part of his territory would effectively be annexed.
It feels as if Brexit talks are falling apart. Trust is disappearing. A deal looks further and further away.
In any case, the EU will remain calm, vigilant, respectful.
And it all comes down to one thing that both sides are trying desperately to avoid.
We do not want to see the return of customs checks and tariffs on our island. And the reason for that goes beyond economics. It goes beyond trade. It goes back to the kind of experience my country and I have gone through in my own lifetime.
The long history of tension over the Irish border is at the heart of the most difficult dilemma facing Brexit negotiators. How can the UK leave the customs union without a return to border checks? It is the question that Boris Johnson and Ireland's leader Leo Varadkar will be addressing as they meet this week. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, Brexit and the Irish border. Lisa, just explain why the Irish border is such a contentious issue.
The Irish border issue has existed for over 100 years.
Lisa O'Carroll is The Guardian's Brexit correspondent.
It goes right back to partition when Ireland broke from the United Kingdom. And it became a dreadful, dreadful period of Irish and British history.
Violence like this hit Northern Ireland in 1969 after years of simmering bitterness between the Catholic minority and the ruling Protestant regime.
Over 3,000 people killed.
It is religion above all which divides this land.
Paramilitaries on both sides of the argument, a constitutional and historical and a war essentially. The Troubles is a bit of a euphemism for what actually happened. And you can see the scars in Northern Ireland still today in the form of, ironically, they're called peace walls.
And when you talk about peace walls, which divided the communities of nationalist Catholics and unionist Protestants, they serve as an incredibly visual reminder of what went on, don't they?
They are, and they're a reminder of the fear that exists in some parts in Northern Ireland. They're generally concrete, some of them are graffitied, they're 8 metres tall. They have turnstiles where people can travel from, say, the Shankill to the Falls Road in West Belfast during the day, but they're closed at night. You know, in some parts in Belfast, peace walls are a tourist attraction, but there's actually a real tragic history behind them.
And finally, after so many years of heartache, in 1998, we got the Good Friday Agreement. It set up a historic power-sharing agreement between unionists and Republicans in Northern Ireland. And it formed the basis of a new relationship between Britain and Ireland, one which crucially would have an invisible border, one where there were no physical checks.
Well, it was an agreement that took a long time. It gave people the right to identify as Irish or British or both. So if you're in Northern Ireland, you can carry a British passport or an Irish passport, or you can carry both. Another core principle is the principle of consent, which obliged Stormont, which is the devolved government in Belfast, to pass legislation only if it had the consent of both communities.
And the Good Friday Agreement set up, in a very dramatic way at the time, what felt like quite a fragile peace after many decades of violence and trouble and heartache. But if we fast forward to 2016, it feels as if that was almost forgotten amidst the fierce debate of the referendum campaign. I mean, the big crunch points were immigration.
What do they know? What do they know of the impact of immigration on
the EU budget?
Why are we sending £10 billion a year net to Brussels?
Questions about the NHS.
And hospital waiting lists and GP surgeries. They know nothing about
it. I mean, I saw a statistic that said the amount that the Irish border was covered in the UK press was less than 1% of the total during that referendum. And yet it has totally dominated the debate ever since.
Yeah, I suppose those people who are involved in the Good Friday Agreement would say Northern Ireland had disappeared from the headlines in the UK for very good reason. It meant there was peace. And so it was in the referendum, because the referendum really wasn't about Northern Ireland. It was about all the things that UKIP wanted, which was controls on immigration and independence from the EU. Northern Ireland was an afterthought for most people.
But in the end, how important has Northern Ireland and the question of the border been ever since the referendum result?
Well, it ultimately was Theresa May's downfall, wasn't it?
Northern Ireland does not have to rely on the Irish government or the European Union to prevent a return to borders of the past. The UK government will not let that happen. I will not let that happen.
The Irish border backstop, she tried to get it through Parliament 3 times and failed.
The government will now redouble its efforts to get a deal that this House can support.
But it hasn't gone away with Theresa May's demise as Prime Minister. It's still dominating the Brexit negotiations.
The early and key challenge for May was about how to take the UK out of the single market, which means EU countries all have the same regulations, and out of the customs union, which is about tariffs and negotiating trade deals as a bloc. That quickly proved difficult, didn't it?
So the issue for Theresa May started just a few months after the referendum, when she was so keen to squash UKIP. So she came out very early on, revealed her hands were 2 red lines, no single market, no customs union. And then somebody kind of tapped her on the shoulder and said, by the way, that would create a hard border in Ireland. We can't have that under the Good Friday Agreement. So hey presto, she had a circle that she could not square. Stay out of the single market, the customs union, and have an invisible border. It's impossible to tick all three.
She thought that she did find a solution. Both sides agreed that they needed a fallback position that would keep Northern Ireland inside the customs union to maintain a soft border if future trade talks fell apart. And they came up with the backstop. The EU was happy for that only to apply to Northern Ireland. But Theresa May argued that it should be UK-wide to prevent a border down the Irish Sea. And as we now know, rebel MPs, including Boris Johnson, defied her 3 times.
The ayes to the right, 242. The noes to the left, 391.
The deal fell and her premiership finished. So it's no surprise that as Prime Minister, he hasn't been willing to go that far. Instead, he put forward what he called a compromise. What did that say?
There are 3 main elements to Boris's deal. That Northern Ireland, number one, it stays in the single market for goods and for agri-food, which means there would be checks on any goods going from Great Britain to Ireland. Number two, there will be customs checks. We don't know where, but somewhere in Northern Ireland on goods travelling from Northern Ireland to the Republic. And number three, also very contentious in Northern Ireland, is that the deal would only happen if the Assembly in Stormont, the devolved government, would endorse it, and that would require consent from both sides.
And as Boris Johnson prepares to meet Leo Varadkar, the Irish Prime Minister, or Taoiseach, things are not looking good, are they?
No, they're not. If there's any chance of a deal, it's an outside chance. But we had a senior member of the Irish government say just before this meeting that the stakes are so high, it would be irresponsible of them not to meet, whatever the circumstances that have been set up in this extraordinary week.
I think it's going to be very difficult to secure an agreement.
Varadkar was on RTE saying that it would be very, very difficult to seal a deal.
Essentially, what the United Kingdom has done is repudiated the deal that we negotiated in good faith with Prime Minister May's government over 2 years, and have sort of put half of that now back on the table.
The EU meet next Thursday. So in order for a deal to go through, there needs to be an agreement by Monday.
We've had an incredibly heated week since that extraordinary briefing to The Spectator that appears to be a text message from Johnson's chief strategist, Dominic Cummings, threatening to withdraw security cooperation from countries that agree to delay Brexit. and hold an election gunning for no deal. Things have really kicked off, haven't they?
They have. That was an absolute game changer in an extraordinary week. And if talks didn't die after that WhatsApp message that we believe was from Dominic Cummings, it certainly put talks on life support. It was followed very, very quickly by a readout from number 10 again. We don't know how authorised it was, but it was about the phone call that Angela Merkel had with Boris Johnson.
The Prime Minister spoke to Angela Merkel this morning. Number 10 says she dismissed the latest plans.
Normally these types of phone calls, especially at such sensitive times, remain confidential. But no, we heard that Angela Merkel had apparently changed the position of the EU, that Northern Ireland had to stay in a customs union forever, and essentially a deal was impossible. Basically, the scene was set for failure. There's an exasperation in Downing Street that the DUP have moved on their red line and they expect the EU to match that and that they haven't. However, in the EU, there's a completely different take that this is Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson setting up the blame game that comes when no deal comes to pass. So we had that extraordinary tweet from Donald Tusk, the EU Council President, saying that, you know, this is juvenile behaviour, this isn't a game. And if we return to Twitter, we can read it out in full. He said, what's at stake is not winning some stupid blame game. At stake is the future of Europe and the UK. You don't want a deal, you don't want an extension, you don't want to revoke, quo vadis, which means where are you going?
And that kind of is the question for both sides, isn't it? If this offer is not acceptable, then where is this going? Is there any point between Northern Ireland staying in a full customs union and no deal? Because that's what we're trying to land in. Do you think there's any chance that Johnson could move further towards the position that Brussels wants him to?
So I hear that Downing Street have made it very plain in briefings that a Northern Ireland specific backstop, even with a timeline, is a non-starter. And this is probably because the Democratic Unionist Party, who have already shifted on their red line about checks in the Irish Sea, won't budge further. And as we know, the DUP have been the linchpin in Parliament in the last 2 years with their 10 votes and their confidence supply agreement with the Tory party.
We've always said that there's only one red line in these matters, and that's when we are treated differently from the rest of the United Kingdom in terms of customs, in terms of regulatory alignment.
That reliance on the DUP for the Conservatives has been critical. Arguably, their failure to back Theresa May ultimately cost her her job. And without an election, Boris Johnson also needs them if he is to make any further compromises to Brussels. The Guardian's Ireland correspondent Rory Carroll has been reporting on the party. Rory, what do the DUP stand for?
The most overriding objective is the protecting the union between Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
We know that our fundamental role is to strengthen the union and to advance Northern Ireland's place within it.
Everything else is secondary to that, including, it would now seem, the economy of Northern Ireland, livelihoods in Northern Ireland, and paradoxically, the constitutional stability of Northern Ireland, but all seem to be sacrificed on the DUP's perception of maintaining the union between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. And there's kind of a tunnel vision in seeing Brexit through the prism of this 100-year-old battle to make sure that Northern Ireland does not in any way, shape or form slide towards a united Ireland.
And that history has had a huge personal impact on the leader of the DUP, Arlene Foster.
Yes, the key to understanding Arlene Foster really is her background. She grew up on the border in Fermanagh in a rural area. She was born in 1970, just 1 year after the Troubles began. And that community that she grew up in, a Protestant community, felt besieged by the IRA. In fact, some would use terms like ethnic cleansing because these were kind of remote rural areas, narrow laneways, hedgerows, and the IRA waged a ruthless campaign of killings, mostly against soldiers and policemen, but often these were people who were also like milkmen and farmers. And so this community felt very much under attack. And she herself, when she was 8 years old, her father, who was a part-time policeman, was on the family farm, and he was ambushed. An IRA gunman shot him in the head. Her father staggered into the family home, and Arlene, 8 years old, was there, and she saw her father on his hands and knees crawling into the family home. Now, he survived, But you can imagine the impact that would have had on any child. It was a horrific event. And 10 years later, now she's a teenager, she's on a school bus when a bomb rips through the bus. And again, it was the IRA. This time they were targeting the bus driver, who was a part-time soldier. The girl seated beside Arlene was very badly injured. Named Foster herself emerged physically more or less unscathed. But again, you can just imagine what impact that would have on anybody.
It was a traumatic time growing up along the border in the 70s and 80s. And I carry that with me. I'm just glad that my children don't have to carry that with them.
And she is completely within her rights to consider that the IRA were just an abomination, and that it was an attempt to bomb and shoot unionists out of the United Kingdom. And, you know, and she now sees it as her mission is to make sure that that never happens, even though there's no longer an IRA campaign. And so that, to some extent, explains the rigidity, as some people would see it, of the DUP towards the Brexit negotiations.
If no deal were to happen, it would be devastating for Northern Ireland. And presumably that must have political implications for the DUP.
Well, not necessarily. And that's what makes Northern Ireland such a fascinating, weird place, because, yes, it would have almost certainly have devastating economic consequences for Northern Ireland, potentially very destabilizing constitutional consequences. And yet in the short term, electorally, it would not necessarily be damaging for the DUP, because where would unionist voters go if they suddenly feel the chill winds of a united Ireland coming? They're going to run for the hardest line unionists to kind of protect their position, and that will be the DUP.
And while the politicians tussle over the Brexit deal, what are you finding when you're reporting on the ground, talking to people, talking to businesses who might be affected by this?
People are exhausted, bewildered, anxious, and disbelieving that we're at this point. Chief executives of big companies, truck drivers who drive dairy trucks backwards and forwards, farmers who herd sheep from one side of the field to the other, divided by the border, are all in a similar position in thinking that, profoundly worried that they're on the cusp of a precipice, and that in a few weeks' time, the economy of Northern Ireland could take a severe hit. And this is already one of the weakest regions economically in the UK. And yet their own kind of political representatives, you know, seem to be this deaf to these kind of howl of worry.
Lisa, this feels scary, urgent, critical. The final EU Council before the Brexit deadline of October the 31st is next week. We seem to be a long way from a workable deal. MPs are now going to sit in Parliament on the Saturday after the council meeting. They've passed legislation that says Boris Johnson must request a delay to Brexit if he hasn't agreed to a deal at that summit. Will he do that?
Well, you could say we're in the last chance saloon, we're right against the wire, but there are 7 days to go. We've got Farquhar and Johnson. I don't think anybody's expecting a deal to emerge from that. But if a space could be opened up where the makings of a deal could be negotiated, maybe we'll get to that position, but we're certainly not in deal territory. Parliament will have a special sitting on Saturday the 19th, which is the deadline for Boris Johnson to write that letter to the EU asking for an extension if there is no deal. Now, Dominic Cummings has, in that WhatsApp message that we referred to earlier, has suggested that he has some cunning plan up his sleeve that nobody knows about. And I think everybody expects that, if anything, Boris Johnson will defy the law and become a Brexit martyr, burnishing his credentials even more for an election.
And the reason that Johnson hints at somehow trying to get around that legislation is because he despises it. In fact, very controversially, he calls it the Surrender Act. Why is that?
Because he feels that the BEN Act is designed to remove no deal as an option. He believes that that is taking away a key weapon in any negotiation, which is to have the right to walk away if negotiations and talks break down.
And in the meantime, one of his senior ministers, Michael Gove, is publishing more information on no deal, claiming that Britain wouldn't put up a border if that happens on the island of Ireland. The Tories are clearly preparing for an election in which it increasingly looks like they will be offering no deal as the policy. in the end, is Brexit, with the whole of the UK leaving the customs union, simply not compatible with the Good Friday Agreement? Or if it is it something that we simply don't have time to solve now?
Well, that's been the argument all along, that leaving the single market and the customs union is not compatible with keeping that border invisible in Northern Ireland.
But ironically, failure to solve this might result in the most extreme outcome, no deal, which could in turn lead to that hard border everyone's trying to avoid.
It's an extremely difficult issue that has been raised by a referendum which didn't consider the border.
Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Lisa O'Carroll and Rory Carroll. Follow all their reporting and that of our Brussels and Westminster teams on the website. Coming up, why is African literature so overlooked? Now, Professor Wendy Laura Belcher of Princeton University has found that despite its rich and diverse history, African literature is often met with a long line of mistaken beliefs.
I get a variety of interesting responses when someone asks me what I do, and I say that I'm a professor of African literature. One American said to me, "You teach African literature? That must be a short course." That's a verbatim quote. Another American said to me, "You teach African literature? Do students take that?" And I was about to respond, yes, they do, when his wife chastised him and said, "Don't be rude, she can't help that." So this inability of people around the world to recognize the breadth and depth of African literature is truly staggering. How is this still possible when Nigerian literature is one of the great national literatures of the 20th century? How is this still possible when South Africa has more Nobel laureates in literature than 90% of the world? Aside from all that, the biggest problem is the adamant refusal to consider that African literature is something more than 60 years old. For most, if they know anything about African literature, they think that African literature started in 1958 with Chinua Achebe's brilliant novel, Things Fall Apart, and that everything before it is blank darkness. But African literature starts long before that. And when I'm having conversations with people trying to talk about the research that I do, instead of believing me, the mental barrier is so great that people begin to correct me. Sometimes members of the public, but often academics. I say, "Nice to meet you. I teach and study 14th century through 19th century African literature." There's usually a long pause then. And then they'll say something like, "Oh, you mean oral literature?" And I'll say, "No, I mean written African literature, like I said." Then if they're knowledgeable, they might correct me by saying, "Oh, you mean like Equiano." Equiano's a really important and famous African author of the 18th century who wrote in English in Britain. And I say, "Yes, I do study him, but most of those I study aren't writing outside of Africa, but in Africa." The next correction I'll get is, "You mean, oh yeah, Africans writing in European languages in Africa." And I'll say, "No, most of those I study are writing in African languages in Africa." Then they'll say, "Oh, you mean like North African authors?" And this is the most typical response I get. And I'll say, "I am interested in North African authors, but most of those I study are early West African and East African authors." Then they'll say, "Oh, you mean like poetry, you know, there's not that much that's going on." And I'll say, "Yes, I am interested in poetry, but I am currently writing an article arguing that the first African novel was written in the 10th or 11th century." And at this point, the other person says, "Wait, what?" And we finally can have a conversation where I am not getting corrected. So look, I'm here to tell you, whatever limits you can imagine for African literature, it exceeds them. It exceeds them in terms of era. It's earlier than you think. In genre, it's broader than you think. In region, it is not just North Africa. In language, it is not just European languages or North African languages. And it's not just for Europeans. Before the 20th century, Africans wrote not just in Europe, but also on the African continent. They wrote not just in European languages, but in African languages. They wrote not just for Europeans, but for themselves. They wrote not just in Northern Africa, but in Sub-Saharan Africa. They wrote not just orally, but textually. They wrote not just historical or religious texts or poetry, but epic and biography. And they wrote not just in the 19th century, but in the 18th century and the 17th century and the 16th century and long, long before.
That was Wendy Laura Belcher, who is Professor of Medieval, Early Modern and Modern African Literature at Princeton University. That's it for today. My thanks to Lisa O'Carroll, Rory Carroll and Wendy Laura Belcher. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Axel Kakutier, who was also, of course, responsible for the sound design. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.